Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins, and this is Charlotte Talks. Today, Brooke Gladstone joins us from WNYC in New York. She is the co-host of On the Media, heard on 420 radio stations across the country, including WFAE here in Charlotte on Sundays at 4 o'clock. She has just published The Trouble with Reality, A Rumination on Moral Panic in Our Time. In case you missed the hint in her title, Brooke has detected a wee bit of unease surrounding the 2016 campaign and the Trump administration's shaky relationship with verifiable facts. Remember the inauguration attendance flap? Or Trump insisting his was, quote, the biggest electoral college win since Ronald Reagan? As NBC News noted, since 1972, only George W. Bush and Jimmy Carter have received fewer electoral votes than Donald Trump. With an abundance of additional examples, Confefe, for example, I'll spare you the full rundown and instead welcome Brooke Gladstone to Charlotte Talks. So, Brooke, The Trouble with Reality.
Hi.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like the feel-good beach read of the summer we've all been waiting for, right?
Well, at least it won't take very long. I call it a rumination because it's really me diving down a bunch of rabbit holes, trying to figure out why this feels worse for so many people than other elections that simply haven't gone their way. I mean, it seems to go beyond, for those who didn't want Trump in office, this seems to go beyond the president or beyond the election. It seems to shake certain fundamental beliefs about how our reality works, some foundational notions of the way the world works. And that's what creates a kind of existential queasiness that's beyond even fear.
You know, one of the things I wondered about when I was reading the book is, though you and I are both teenagers, we do remember 2000. And the George W. Bush, Al Gore, the settling of that race by the Supreme Court, while it was very controversial and upset people, it did not seem to have the same impact in terms of people questioning the very pillars of our democracy.
Right, right. We saw a glitch, and we used the court to settle it, and the court made its choice. And Scalia once told a reporter friend of mine who raised this, "Will you guys ever get over that?" You know, it's always going to be there as a big question mark. For those who might remember Kennedy's election, concerns about Illinois will always linger, right? Mm-hmm. It's just the system does not work perfectly. And sometimes there are some profound failures in it. But this wasn't about how the democracy is a system, right? It's just a template. It's a way to organize things. And we believe that this is the very, very best system. But if we believe that we have just elected a demagogue and somebody who is maybe dangerous to the fundamental values that we thought were shared, then we think we're forced to think that maybe democracy doesn't work, that democracy is only as good, it's just a machine, and it's only as good as the people who operate the levers. And you probably know that in the back of the book, I quote John Adams, who said exactly that. Democracy isn't any more durable than anything else. It's, you know, the people who populate it are subject to the same vanities and the same greed and the same fears as every other system is. And so it forces all of us to take a greater responsibility. This machine does not turn on its own.
One of the things you write about is helping Democrats and perhaps some Republicans better understand how Trump won despite making claims that were outlandish and misrepresenting facts in a way that was well beyond the accepted political norms. And I'm wondering, along those lines, how much stock do you put in the other side? That is, the media turning to J.D. Vance, who is the author of Hillbilly Elegy, and turning to Michael Moore to understand Trump voters.
Well, you see, this is the problem, is that the media didn't understand the media. Those of us ensconced on the coasts and in big cities, which means most of us, just didn't understand Trump voters, still don't understand Trump voters. And, you know, that's why I call it the trouble with reality. The way I posit that we all are wired to construct our own realities. And these are different from even just the echo chambers or the bubbles that we talk about. I mean, on an absolutely fundamental level, we construct our universe, and there are certain things we leave out of it. And some of our beliefs in democracy and some of our understanding of the people out there that we don't see, those of us on the coast, have led us, even when we did go to cover Trump voters, we didn't ask the right questions. And we still persist in not asking the right questions. If we don't thoroughly understand how they view their lives, then we won't be able to stick our own realities back together in a way that is more durable, that won't fall apart the next time there's an election or the next time there's a disaffected population who can have more influence than we realized, either how that it was decisively big enough or decisively big enough under our electoral college system, that there are people that we have forgotten or people that we never knew and thought we did.
Well, and along those lines, you know, there for people who are upset about President Trump and the way things went in November, and I mentioned earlier, there are numerous examples of easily disproved statements by candidate Trump and President Trump. You know, one that comes to mind is his speech at the CIA in January when he said he loved the intelligence community and he blamed the media for creating a false impression otherwise. And of course, less than two weeks earlier, in a tweet, Trump had compared U.S. intelligence to Nazism. And I think for people who are troubled by Donald Trump, they wonder why a discrepancy like that isn't more powerful with his constituency.
Because it doesn't matter. They, you know, that is the scariest part of Trump's mode of doing business, is that he isn't just creating an alternate reality. I mean, Karl Rove told New York Times reporter Ron Suskind, you know, back in the era of George W. Bush, that we will keep throwing alternate realities at you, and you guys in the, quote, reality-based community are just going to have to get used to it. But the reality that they created in the run-up to the Iraq war, which we know now was false, intentionally or otherwise, or a mixture of intentional falsehoods with unintentional assumptions and all of that, they created a world that demanded the invasion of Iraq. And it was consistent. It was to an end. This is how that differs from what Trump did. And I'm going to quote, as I do in the book, from Hannah Arendt, who observed a similar kind of phenomenon happening in the run-up to the Second World War. She said, "The result of a consistent and total substitution of lies for factual truth is not that the lie will now be accepted as truth and truth defamed as a lie, but that the sense by which we take our bearings in the real world, the category of truth versus falsehood as a mental means to an end, is being destroyed." In other words, what Trump is doing when he lies and contradicts himself and says one thing today and one thing tomorrow and knows that he'll never be hung up by that, is that you can't know the truth. The engines of accountability, like the media, have their own agenda and will lie to you. It doesn't matter if you'll get lies from me, you'll get lies from that. That is not how you should determine what you believe. Take my deal. The truth is unknowable. Facts are unprovable. And therefore, you can have no common basis on which to negotiate. Democracy is a negotiation. People of goodwill coming to different conclusions from the same basic pool of information and then figuring out who gets the most votes. If you don't have a common pool of facts, you don't have any incentive to negotiate, and that opens the way to authoritarianism.
you're hearing the voice of Brooke Gladstone. She's the author of a new book called The Trouble with Reality, and she's the co-host of WNYC's On the Media, which is heard here on Sunday afternoons on WFAE. We're talking about not only President Trump, but just the whole new world of alternative facts and fake news, and voters sometimes often frustrated by the disparities and the change in our media and political culture of late. I want to ask you about your references in the book to Philip K. Dick, the very well-known science fiction author, mm-hmm. and appropriate choice, obviously. You describe his lifelong unease over defining reality, and you note that today a similar disquiet afflicts, quote, those of us whose reality embodies liberal values. So mm-hmm. how do you know that the moral panic you're writing about and discussing isn't merely bitter rationalization because Hillary Clinton lost?
Because, you know, the same group of liberals were embittered when George Bush won. I mean, I maintain that this is very different. And I argue in the book precisely, I identify some of those liberal values that seem to have suddenly been called into question. The kinds of rules by which we sort of order our world and understand how the universe works, how people function. And these things, a lot of these are liberal values with a small L, not in the, you know, big D democratic sense of the word, but just what do we believe human beings are motivated by? How will they use information? Are we basically wired to care about the world, or are we not wired that way? And what about democracy? That is the best system, and it's because it operates invariably along these lines, and it doesn't. Yeah, a lot of people are embittered that Hillary didn't win. A lot of people are embittered that Bernie didn't win. There are probably a lot of people out there who really wish John Kasich or Jeb Bush or Marco Rubio would have. I argue from the very first sentence that this just goes beyond one particular election, that this really goes to where we live in our own lives and go through the world and what we have to do in order to feel better and to be better situated in our little world, in the much bigger world outside, so that we can hold it together.
Now, key question about your book, you mentioned that reality itself is engaged in an epic existential battle against the onslaught as the truth is trampled into dust. Now, here's the important question. Urban Dictionary defines trampled with a capital T as, quote, to experience the negative effects of association with Donald Trump. But you did not capitalize your T, so I have to wonder, do you have trouble with trampled?
That is unbelievable research, Eric. I had no idea that this word was even in the Urban Dictionary. I thought I made it up. So there you go. So I gave it an entirely different meaning. What I meant by it was that the very notion of truth is, basically pulverized to the point where it can't be reconstructed.
Now you know. We need to take a quick break, but when we come back, we'll dissect the president's Twitter habit with Brooke Gladstone and more. This is Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and NC Warn, working to slow climate change by curbing methane emissions from the fracked gas and power industries. Information on clean energy alternatives at ncwarn.org. And from the Pump House Restaurant, featuring a Southern-inspired cuisine in a restored multi-level pump house with a rooftop bar located at the Riverwalk in Rock Hill. More info at rockhillpumphouse.com. Coming up tomorrow on Charlotte Talks, babies weren't always born in hospitals. They were born at home with the help of a midwife. The age-old practice of midwifery never really disappeared, but has seen a resurgence in recent years. Now midwives practice in hospitals, birth centers, and occasionally at home. But laws regulating midwifery vary from state to state. There are even differences between North and South Carolina. We'll look at some of those differences, meet local midwives, and hear from moms about why they call the midwife when Charlotte Talks tomorrow at 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. Coming up on the next On Point, the stabbings in Portland, Oregon, and on the University of Maryland campus, we'll look at the rise of hate in America. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
Join On Point ahead at 10 o'clock right after Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE.
We're back on Charlotte Talks. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins, and I'm speaking with Brooke Gladstone, who's the co-host of On the Media, and she is also the author of the new book, The Trouble with Reality. Let's hear a little bit of Brooke's day job. This is a clip from your interview with Russian journalist Masha Gessen, who has reported in the U.S. for a number of years. She's talking here about facts and truth in the age of Trump.
I was just reading Marty Barron's, the editor of the Washington Post, speech when he was receiving the Christopher Hitchens Award. He said, well, everybody is asking, what do we do now? And the answer is simple, just do our jobs, and our job is to tell the truth as near as it can be ascertained. I was really disappointed because I thought it was glib, because what I really would have wanted him to do is focus on the gap between facts and truth. We have to figure that out. We have to figure out sort of its size and its shape and how it keeps changing and how we bridge that gap.
So how do you think we bridge that gap?
She really started me on this road in a lot of ways. Something else she said to me was that it isn't just that both Putin and Trump lie. It's that they lie in the same way and for the same purpose, blatantly to assert power over truth itself. You know, it's the abundance of lies. It demonstrates again and again that facts are disposable, confusing devices. They don't serve you. They don't matter. And essentially, he just floods the ether with conflicting assertions until you really do come to believe that because facts are really unknowable, they're all debatable, that you can trust no one, that you might as well just pick the ones you like and ignore the rest.
But she's talking about it not being enough to just supply the facts. You know, the New York Times in particular is one that leaps to mind. They do these stories every day. They'll have a box of maybe Mick Mulvaney's press conference on the budget or something, and they'll say, this is false, this is misleading, this is partially misleading. So, but what she's saying is
that's not
enough.
I didn't answer your question, and now I do, and now I will answer the question. Here's the conclusion that I've come to. It's not that the media or the news media should stop fact-checking. That's part of the job.
Sure.
You want to know what's right and what's wrong, but you cannot stop there. Unless you want to preach to the converted, and unless your true message over and over and over again ad infinitum is that the president is a liar, which everybody knows, whether you're a supporter or you're not a supporter, you know he doesn't tell the truth because he changes his positions from day to day, and anybody who pays attention knows that. So it isn't that. And every time you check a fact, you say he and his administration are a bunch of liars, you're not advancing the conversation. We have to work a lot harder as an institution to contextualize those facts, to make them relevant to people's lives. Because, as I argue in the book, we construct our realities in a particular way, and we do not want to change them unless it cannot be avoided. And the way to make a fact, a true fact, irresistible to someone who might be resistant to it is to explain why it is relevant to them. If it's just lists of fact checks, they are so easy to ignore. They're satisfying to Trump haters. They're irrelevant to people who look to Trump for help in their situation, whatever it may be. They're just irrelevant. He made some promises. We don't care about this other stuff. It's all inside the Beltway politics. You have to explain why this correction, why this fact, why this assumption, why this assertion makes a difference to me. And we've done a pretty bad job of that institutionally, although certainly not every institution, but I mean, every media outlet. But as a whole, we never made it relevant, the fact that he lies about certain things and lies consistently. That's what we have to do.
One other thing that she mentions, you include this in your book, is the fact that, and she has this interesting perspective because, as I mentioned, she is Russian, but she's been reporting in America for a number of years. So she sees both countries in a much clearer way than most of us do. And she talks about how it is fascinating to her the psychology of Americans playing up the Russian meddling in the election and the connections with Vladimir Putin, because it is a way of saying that we as Americans didn't do this. It was outsiders who caused this disturbance in our democracy.
Right, exactly. And if we love, conspiracy theories rush in when the information is either missing or unsatisfying. And we can talk all day long about the conspiracy theories that flood the right ecosystem, the right wing echo chambers. But one that is very, very much embraced in the left wing echo chambers has to do with this notion that the Russians stole this election. We know that the Russians meddled in the election. There's no debate about that. We don't know yet about collusion. You know, that is, whether or not that's the case is to come after the investigation. But we do know they meddled. But any number of things can turn just a few thousand votes in one direction or another to win Trump the Electoral College. To say it was the Russians is to say our democracy is perfect. Our people would not vote for a person like Trump. We were manipulated from the outside. As Masha said it so well, we Americans love to otherize the threat. The threat has to come from the other. It can't come from within. And if we don't accept that it came from within, we can't own it. We can't address it. We can't figure out how to make the situation such that people who might not otherwise have voted for Trump felt driven to do it. All of these things go out of reach when we otherize the threat. And that is an American conspiracy theory. I am perfectly willing to accept anything that they come up with, the FBI and the NSA and so on. And collusion, with so many people in the campaign and the administration having ties with Russia, it certainly is not of the question that there was active collusion. We'll find out. But even so, we have to own that this is if you see Trump as a problem, this is an American problem. And that's something that Masha, as someone who grew up in Russia, saw much better than many of us.
Again, you're listening to Brooke Gladstone. She's the author of the new book, The Trouble with Reality, A Rumination on Moral Panic in Our Time. And she's also the co-host of WNYC's On the Media, which can be heard here on WFAE every Sunday at 4 p.m. Soon after Donald Trump took office, one of his closest advisors, Kellyanne Conway, coined an unforgettable phrase during an interview with NBC's Chuck Todd. Here's what she said.
And you did not answer the question.
You did not answer
the question of why the president asked the White House press secretary to come out in front of the podium for the first time and utter a falsehood. Why did he do that? It undermines the credibility of the entire White House press office
Don't be so overly dramatic about it, Chuck. You're saying it's a falsehood, and they're giving Sean Spicer, our press secretary, gave alternative facts to that. But the point remains.
Wait a minute. Alternative facts, four of the five facts he uttered. Zeke Miller, four of the five facts he uttered were just not true. Look, alternative facts are not facts. They're falsehoods.
So obviously this has become an infamous interview, and even if you don't follow politics, most people are familiar with that exchange, or at least the phrase alternative facts. But what I'm wondering is, you know, this goes back to something you were discussing earlier, which is this idea that it really doesn't change much, or it doesn't seem to change much in terms of both sides. People who are with
right.
Trump don't seem to be that disturbed by that exchange. And people on the left or Democrats say, I told you so. So why is it so ineffective to point out a falsehood?
This is why. And I'll begin with Arendt again here. And I'm going to begin with her, even though she chronicled the rise of Hitler and Stalin, not to say, emphatically not to say, that Trump is anything like those people or that his followers are anything like the Nazis or, I mean, you know, we can do the demographics and break down the Trump voter and see if we can get closer to an understanding of why they voted the way they did. But that said, and with, you know, with that qualification, I'm going to say that she had the important quote on this. She said, you know, the people, the modern masses, she called it, and she meant then the disaffected masses, the starving masses, the people who voted for Hitler. They don't believe anything visible. What convinces masses are not facts, not even invented facts, but the consistency of the system in which they are presumably part. In other words, that world that we each construct, that we believe in about how things work. And even though Trump's system was unmoored to the facts, it ran on the idea that truth is only, the real truth is only what the establishment types don't want to talk about. And his world was consistent. Jason Stanley, a Yale professor and author of How Propaganda Works, said that, you know, Trump's world came with its own values. And the values were that non-whites and non-Christians are the chief threats to law and order. You know, Trump knows that reality does not call for a value system like his. Violent crime is at almost historic lows. But he's thundering about a crime wave of historic proportions, wrote Stanley, because he's an authoritarian using his speech to define a reality that legitimizes his value system. And then it's easy for the voters to adopt it. He underscored what his supporters already believed, that the politicians, the professors, the scientists, the coastal elites who wept great salt tears over immigrants and minorities didn't care about, didn't see them, didn't see the coming catastrophe which they felt in their bones. And Trump basically struck a bargain. He said, just believe whatever I say, even if it contradicts the reality of your own experience, because I know the system is rigged, you know the system is rigged, and I will rig the system for you. And anyway, the truth itself is a liar, because it's not consistent with the way you see the world.
Well, speaking of lies, we have an email from a listener named Kirby who says that Brooke seems confident in using the word lie, but NPR and NPR stations like WFAE have been cautious about calling the president's statements lies. So Kirby asked, why do you feel so comfortable using the term lie to describe what President Trump says?
As a media analysis program, we think about this question a lot. And a lie, as opposed to a falsehood, say, or a misstatement, implies intentionality. And I guess that there are times when he is just mistaken, and we've used that too, and there are times when it just seems to be intentional for a reason, or he doesn't really care whether it's true or not. There was this great book that I can't say the title on broadcast, but I'll just say it was called On BS. And it was written by a professor who distinguished between somebody who's just a liar and someone who is a BSer. and someone who's just wrong. Now, somebody who is a BSer, as opposed to a liar who is lying to a particular end, the BSer doesn't really care whether it's true or not. It could be true. It could be false. The validity of what he is saying is utterly irrelevant. The point here is simply to influence the way somebody feels and influence for a moment their belief, but only for a moment. He's not creating a consistent world necessarily, because he doesn't really care what's true or what isn't. And so we use the word because Trump's departure from the world of demonstrable facts and evidence was so profound compared to any other politician that we've encountered. And let's face it, as the great journalist Izzy Stone said, every politician lies, every president lies. Lies fuel politics. But this kind of endless stream to call into question the very possibility of provable fact itself calls for less civil, neutral, or I don't even want to use the word, less indirect speech. I mean, I think the media for the last 70 years or so have struck a deal that people think that the media have a liberal bias. That could very well be true, probably is true, but that's not what affects their reporting. In fact, you see example after example of false balance, giving, you know, unequal time, giving equal time to thoroughly unequal positions like global warming in order to counter the idea that they're liberal. In fact, they're not doing their audience a service.
Sort of equivocating yourself to death. By the way, that's the voice of Brooke Gladstone, who's just shattered our notion of George Washington and the cherry tree in that last answer. Let's talk a little bit about...
But I just want to say that the media's deepest, most profound bias is a status quo bias. We think we understand how the world works, and we want it to work that way. And part of the status quo, part of the civility, is using this equivocal speech. And I think we're past the time where we avoid calling a lie there.
Let's talk a little bit about Twitter. As some people may know, President Trump is fond of Twitter. He has 30.9 million followers on Twitter. He ranks as the 32nd most followed person. He does trail Barack Obama by a wide margin, as well as LeBron James and Katy Perry, who's number one, in case anyone was wondering out there. but I think in the minds of many people, because first of all, I think journalists always forget that a lot of people aren't even on Twitter. But Trump is sort of identified as Twitter in some cases at this point. And you have a Rosetta Stone to understand his methods. Now, I'm leaving you with a minute and change to at least start explaining to us. So why don't you start and we'll pick up on the other side?
Sure. The Trump Twitter sphere follows a certain bunch of rules that were identified by cognitive linguist George Lakoff. A particular tweet is designed to do a particular thing. And I guess after the break, I'll explain what they are. But there are things like preemptive framing, the diversion tweet, the trial balloon, the deflection tweet. You can anatomize these things, and then you can sort of figure out what he's doing beneath what he's doing. And it's very helpful.
You see what a blessing it is to have a radio pro as the guest? So that way I don't have to. Anyway, we're speaking to Brooke Gladstone again. She is the author of The Trouble with Reality. She's the co-host of On the Media. And if you stick around, you'll find out more about President Trump's Twitter habits here on Charlotte Talks.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Tyndall Subaru Gastonia, featuring the new Outback with EyeSight safety technology that sees problems and initiates action to help avoid trouble. Details at TyndallSubaru.com. And from Duke Energy, committed to building a smarter energy future for the Carolinas. More at Duke-Energy.com/future. Coming up at 10 o'clock, hate groups are multiplying in the U.S., and so are hate crimes. In Maryland and Oregon, two recent attacks aimed at minorities left three people dead. KKK chapters and Nazi insignia may be on the decline, but hate groups disguised as nonprofits or think tanks are increasing. So are groups targeting college campuses. On Point looks at the rise of hate in America and what's fueling its surge. That's On Point ahead at 10 o'clock.
Every day you want to know the latest news, but you also want to know what really matters.
The plan calls for cutting the top corporate tax rate from 35%.
They're helping federal immigration authorities. The U.S. Justice Department could try to...
A lot of people do not come to our home school of Sedgefield.
NPR checks facts, talks to people making, influencing, and affected by the day's news. Stand with the facts. Listen every day.
At 90.7 WFAE.
We're back on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins. And my guest today is Brooke Gladstone. She is the author of The Trouble with Reality, and she is also the co-host of On the Media, which airs nationwide, including on WFAE on Sunday afternoons. So, Brooke, I apologize. I set you up there to have a short window, but you were starting to explain the different methods and strategies that President Trump has used on Twitter, which has been so effective for him, not only during the campaign, but I think for his supporters, they like hearing from him as president.
Well, the thing about Trump is he continues a tradition that all presidents have tried to use, that it was used effectively by George W. Bush in going to local press instead of, you know, the big outlets. It was used by Obama on digital media, but no one has bypassed the traditional media as effectively as Trump has, because he delivers most of his points, as I wrote, unmediated, fresh, and fun-sized straight to your screen via Twitter. But these tweets are a lot more complex and more layered than they'd seem. So I mentioned cognitive linguist George Lakoff's taxonomy of Trump tweets, and I'll just give you one example. Preemptive framing. Here's a Trump tweet. Only reason the hacking of the poorly defended DNC is discussed is that the loss by the Dems was so big that they are totally embarrassed. Okay, so the idea here is, in preemptive framing, is to frame the issue before other people get a chance to put the idea out there first. So what did he do here? First, he claims that the hacking of the DNC is not worthy of discussion. Second, he says the Dems lost big when, in fact, of course, Hillary won the popular vote and lost the Electoral College by a slim margin. Third, he implies that the Republican National Committee was better defended, even though we know that the RNC was also hacked by the Russians, only they didn't leak out any of that stuff. So those are three distinct preemptive distortions of reality in one itty-bitty tweet.
Go ahead. I was just going to say, and so all of a sudden, that maybe not fully negates, but it certainly gets around a lot of what might be called the media covfefe.
And, you know, this is the thing, is that, you know, after he woke up and calmed everybody down, I mean, in Europe, when he did that tweet that sounded like he'd passed out in the middle of it and then never finished it, people who were reading tweets in Europe who are up thought something happened to him. That affected markets and all of that. I mean, he's just having a grand old time, isn't he? let me talk about the diversion tweet. You'll remember famously he wrote, "The cast and producers of Hamilton, which I hear is highly overrated, should immediately apologize to Mike Pence for their terrible behavior." This is when Mike Pence came to see a show, and after the show, they wanted to read a statement to Mike Pence. The diversion tweet is used to provoke the mainstream media with an outburst. It's often related to cultural or social issues, but not always. That fills the news cycle with shock or sneers, and it diverts attention, usually from a more important story. In this case, the tweet overshadowed the news that Trump paid out $25 million to settle lawsuits against Trump University for fraud. You know,
pretty effectively.
Oh, yeah,
because that story really did sink pretty quickly.
And boy, how did he know where the media's sweet spot is? Again, the coastal elites. We care about Broadway. We care about theater. How dare you insult Hamilton? You know, this is the kind of thing that really shows the difference, probably, between our various, you know, bubbles that we live in, the various realities that we inhabit. Because I'm sure, as we've seen in still a lot of the media coverage, a lot of the voters for Trump really don't care about Russia. You know, they care about health care, and yet the obsession with Russia, it's very much of an inside the beltway obsession. The deflection tweet, I'll just finish on that one. This is his favorite. This is where he'll dodge responsibility by blaming the messenger. Almost every one of these tweets every tweet about the media falls into this category. For instance, he said, "Just cannot believe a judge would put our country in such peril. If something happens, blame him and the court system. People pouring in, bad." This is about the fact that the courts wouldn't let his travel ban go through. Or, "The real scandal here is that classified information is illegally given out by intelligence like candy. Very un-American." This is another example where, instead of distracting people from examining the substance of the leak, and of course, many hugely important stories that the media have ever covered have begun with leaks. No, you're not supposed to focus on the leak. You're supposed to focus on the leaker. And of course, you know, these rules that apply to his tweets also apply to his spoken remarks as well. But you can understand that whether or not he's a consciously brilliant manipulator or whether he just learned from his business career what works and what doesn't, he was hugely effective as a campaigner. Obviously, we've seen far less so as a sitting president.
And you mentioned, and this has been talked about a lot, not only during the campaign, but particularly since he's been president, Donald Trump both loves and hates the media. And, you know, he is consumed by his coverage when he's not tweeting about his coverage. About a month or so into his presidency, he staged a press conference that was considered to be especially vindictive in terms of antipathy toward the media. And here is some of what he said.
"I'm making this presentation directly to the American people with the media present, which is an honor to have you this morning, because many of our nation's reporters and folks will not tell you the truth and will not treat the wonderful people of our country with the respect that they deserve. And I hope going forward we can be a little bit different and maybe get along a little bit better if that's possible. Maybe it's not, and that's okay too. Unfortunately, much of the media in Washington, D.C., along with New York, Los Angeles, in particular, speaks not for the people, but for the special interests and for those profiting off a very, very obviously broken system. The press has become so dishonest that if we don't talk about it, we are doing a tremendous disservice to the American people. Tremendous disservice. We have to talk about it to find out what's going on, because the press honestly is out of control. The level of dishonesty is out of control."
So, Brooke Gladstone, I think that would be a perfect example of what you're saying about deflection, right? And sort of a greatest hits, because not many people are going to feel empathetic toward the media, are they?
Oh, very few. And I think only about 14% of Republicans actually have any confidence in the media. Now, I have to say that all institutions have really gone downhill. Trusted even less than the media are, according to a Gallup poll, big business and at the very bottom, Congress. At the top, most trusted, the military and small business. Now, with regard to what Trump says, the bigger message there, and I don't even know if that is it's not a small deflection. I mean, it's a big one. I mean,
this is the King Kong of deflections.
Yeah. I mean, he also followed that up with tweets that the fake news media is not my enemy. It is the enemy of the American people. They have their own agenda, and their agenda is not your agenda. Now, Trump is drawn to catchy phrases. And this one inspired a shiver because enemy of the people is the phrase Hitler applied to the Jews, Mao applied to the educated classes, Stalin applied it to almost everyone. It was a clear statement, however, of where Trump stood. He declared that there was no free press in his America and that there was no reason for one, which, of course, runs counter, deeply counter to the founding fathers, who believed that without a free press, there could be no America.
One of the things that I found really interesting in your book is that you delve into the language that Trump uses, and you explore the idea of how Trump uses shorthand, not only in Twitter, but through the campaign, for example. He would come up with these shorthand insults, Little Marco, Crooked Hillary, low-energy Jeb Bush, and it would not only denigrate, but it would instantly sort of shrink his opposition in a way. I'm wondering what impact along the same lines you see from the terms fake news, failing New York Times. By the way, New York Times stock is up 30% since Trump took office. But what impact do you think it's having when he uses that method with the media?
Well, I think that one concern that George Lakoff, the cognitive linguist, had is that these kinds of epithets, you know, like Homer used, you know, fleet-footed Hermes and that kind of thing. Basically, it creates neural pathways. I mean, even if you don't believe that Hillary is crooked, you're still going to have this, with enough repetition, there will be a pathway, there will be a way that your brain goes there, and then you start to have to actively resist it. And, you know, they're like musical earworms. You almost can't get them out of your head. They take up residence, they breed associations, they breed doubt. And, you know, basically this is part of how he fills the ether. He fills the ether with shiny objects that the media can run after, fact-checking, while perhaps losing sight of the bigger story. And he fills the ether with these little leitmotifs, which, again, they're just there. They're present. They're part of the noise. And, it's very clever. I mean, in terms of fake news, that's been co-opted so fast that it's simply, yeah, it's been picked up by local politicians that have, you know, that have climbed onto the Trump train. It's certainly a phrase that is often used at Fox or in Breitbart and other places. It's a shorthand. You said, okay, you know this phrase. If you're on our side, that's all we have to say. It's a shortcut. It says you have permission to ignore the information or not to examine it, to simply close your eyes.
Now, one of the interviews that you include is, and help me with the name, let me make sure I get his name right, is it Michael Signer?
Signer,
I'm
I
sorry.
Think?
Michael Signer. Okay.
You know, I'm pretty sure it's Signer.
See, you're stuck you know, with a kid from Louisiana, so I had no idea what to do with that. Okay, Michael Signer.
Well, we had him on, so I should remember the pronunciation, but yeah, go ahead.
So Michael Signer, he's an expert on demagogues, and he told you...
And he's also a mayor. He's a politician.
Oh, is he really? I didn't realize that. Okay.
Yeah.
So he has both sides covered. He said, quote, "My study of demagogues shows that satire does not work." And I'm wondering what you make of that. You know, are people sort of laughing with Alec Baldwin and Melissa McCarthy on Saturday Night Live, but the joke is on them in a way?
It's satire has a tremendous value in soothing people, in making people feel that they're not crazy. But it will have no impact on somebody who has supported Trump. In fact, it is just as likely to make them even stronger in their support of Trump and less open to alternate points of view. So you can't use satire to bring down a demagogue because he is speaking to his audience, his constituents, on an entirely different level, in an entirely different field of information, flow of information applies. So the only way that you can counter a demagogue's message is by taking him absolutely seriously as his constituents do. If not, you're preaching to the converted, and there is value in that. Makes the converted feel better. But if you want to have some sort of, you know, if I talk about warring realities and how they're broken, if you want to have some cross-reality exchange, laughing at the champion of people that you want to speak to is not the way to go about it.
You mentioned, you cite a couple of studies that are nonpartisan studies that show people who are more conservative politically tend to embrace conspiracy theories to a greater degree than more liberal voters do. But
the slight correction there,
okay.
The people who are out of power, in other words, right now there is an increase in conspiracy theories on the left and a decrease of conspiracy theories on the right. What I noticed in the research is that conservatives tend to embrace apocalyptic conspiracy theories, ones that present an existential danger to a greater extent than lefties do.
Got it.
Lefties
okay.
will embrace conspiracy theories, but not one that herald the end times, that kind of thing.
So, and I appreciate you sorting that out for me. So, along those lines, wouldn't it be entirely reasonable for Republicans and conservative voters to say, "Look, you guys are just sort of embracing. You guys on the left are just embracing conspiracy theories because you're mad. You're out of power."
Yeah, it's reasonable to say that. It's largely true. Now, obviously, a lot of things begin as conspiracy theories and they turn out to be real. Watergate and Exxon.
See, this is the conspiracy. Now I have to cut you
financial,
off.
The financial company and the, there yes. are conspiracies that yes. have turned out to be true.
Brooke Gladstone is the author of The Trouble with Reality. She's the co-host of On the Media, and I appreciate you joining us today from WNYC. Good luck with the
book.
It
was a real pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Mike Collins will be back with you tomorrow. I'm Eric Spanberg from the Charlotte Business Journal, and I enjoyed being with you today on Charlotte Talks.